folks, and welcome back to NTI's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima McGinn, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Native Shark, which is an online platform for learning Japanese. And what Native Shark do is they make learning Japanese really, really simple. You log in, you click a button that says study now, and the platform then shows you exactly what you need to learn next based on your previous progress. Now, again, this is simple, but the way it's designed means that students who use Native Shark once a day for 4 to 5 months can complete the equivalent of over 2 years of university study. And this is not just them patting themselves on the back. Now that Native Shark's been in business for over a year, the results are in. So this is exactly what people are saying. Just looking at a couple of posts in their community forums, and the student community, by the way, is one of the best things about the platform. So one person's writing, most productive year I've had learning Japanese. And then another one says, I've started learning over a year ago with all of these other platforms, and what I learned there is only a fraction of what I've learned on Native Shark in just 3 months. And then yet another one goes, in my mind, my study timeline only started with Native Shark because that's when I really started learning consistently, and on and on. So yet the proof's in the pudding. It's definitely the best online course out there. And since you've heard about it here on the podcast, you also get an extra little bonus. If you sign up for their free trial using the URL nativeshark.com/NTI, and we'll link to it in this episode's show notes. So that's native without an E. So N-A-T-I-V shark, all one word, .com/NTI. You use that link to sign up and you'll get a double length free trial. So 2 weeks free instead of just the one. No need to put in your credit card or anything of that sort. You can just sign up, give it a shot. And chances are at the end of these 2 weeks, you'll already be far ahead of wherever you are with your Japanese at the moment, whether you're just starting out or you're already in knee deep. Give it a shot. nativeshark.com/NTI. Okay, so for today's episode, this is a recording of a recent business call with a new client from Tokyo. And he's come prepared with a really deep list of topics to discuss, which of course enabled me to also provide deeper answers than usual. So we first talk about purchasing with a loan versus all cash, the advantages and disadvantages, and just the different mindset involved in these two strategies. We talk about living in your investment property. So cases where, for instance, someone purchases a small building, lives in one of the units, and then rents out the rest. We also had a really good chat about diversity and hedging and how that looks with different budgets, different property and tenant profiles, different locations. We talk about purchase costs and taxes and buying tenanted versus vacant properties, maintenance, renovation costs, insurance coverage, and a whole lot more. So really nice deep dive into many of the topics that most first-time investors have on their minds before they pull the trigger on their very first deal. I hope you enjoy it, and I'll see you again on the other side.
Yeah, no problem.
Yep, go for it. So I've been looking at your email again, and you've mentioned that you're thinking about a few potential strategies with, without financing and so forth.
Right, exactly. That I mean, quickly, my idea is kind of like trying to figure out a way to get like more like stable, like side income, I guess.
Yeah.
And so as I said in the email, I guess like there's like three different kind of ways at the moment how I would look at it. Just basically like buy in cash by like selling some stocks, or just like save up and then buy in cash, or go with a loan. But I think that's something I would like to talk to you as well. So what do you think about like those things, or like what might make sense? I don't know, like you probably know much better than I do about all those things.
Well, I can't comment about the option of selling other investments to buy into this one because I don't know what the rest of your portfolio is like and if it's
doing right.
With loan or not, I mean, look, obviously a lot of people are into not using their own cash. And many of the people who contact us are of the same mind. Just the things to bear is that one, when you're purchasing with a loan, you're limited to whatever the bank or the lender's criteria specifies. So some of them will only lend for Central Tokyo. Some of them will only lend for certain ages of property or certain purposes. Like you can only use it for long-term residential, for example, you might not be able to do any sort of income hacking by doing short-term rentals. Mm-hmm. They might not consider commercial properties, and so forth. So that's one aspect of it. And the other is that if you're applying for a property and that application is dependent on lender approval, then somebody might come in and just take it off your hands with cash. That's the only thing. Unless you're pre-approved. So if you're pre-approved by the lender and you can submit that pre-approval letter along with your application, then that's not going to be an issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. Yeah, I think from my side as well, I'm not really sure about if, I mean, especially like with like some kind of like first property, if a loan makes sense. I called SMBC Prestia the other day and they don't seem like opposed to like in lending to a person in my situation, but it feels it might be a bit big for like a first property to get like just a...
That's, I guess, the other thing with a loan is that there's always, I mean, in Japan, it's not as much as a risk as in other countries, but there's always the slight risk that if for any reason you can't make payments, they could foreclose. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously never an issue if it's just your cash and it's 100% owned by you from the get-go. But look, I mean, it's really a personal preference. I mean, my wife and I, for example, don't like to take on debt and we don't like to owe money to anyone. We prefer to just build it slow and steady. But I guess 90% of the world are very happy with taking out loans and purchasing property, right? So I mean, I can't presume to relate to your personal circumstances. It's entirely up to you. Maybe it would help if you could tell me, you mentioned stocks. So what are your other investments around the world looking like? Are they sort of... more cash flow oriented, more growth oriented, speculative, less speculative, liquid, non-liquid? What else are you invested in?
Basically, I just started out like I think 3-4 years ago with like all this kind of like financial planning, personal finance. Before that, I was pretty like let's say like financial illiterate, I guess. Yeah. And so what I did now is just basically buy very low cost like mutual funds in Japan, okay, in mainly like tax advantaged accounts.
Yep.
So very standard like worldwide index funds.
So stable, kind of safe, probably not super high on the dividends, but probably quite well positioned to grow over time, kind of thing.
Right. It's much more growth. I think it's like because it's Japanese mutual funds, they basically do not pay out any dividends.
Oh, they don't? I didn't know that.
It's just like reinvested everything that's paid out. So it's much more like growth over time.
Yep.
So I'm looking more for something like on the side that I think is much more like, I guess, something like psychological, I guess, with just like this steady inflow of like money, right? You get like with rental properties, I guess.
Yeah.
It's just like every month you get some kind of like payments, which might help me in my situation. For example, like let's say like in a downturn with the stocks, that you are like less inclined to like say like dabble in there or like sell or like do whatever, like just...
Well, I guess most, that's a factor that you might want to consider, is that most of the lenders will probably, just by virtue of their criteria, they're probably going to direct you towards similar investments on the property side, right? They also prefer a safe and stable, lower yield, but less of a chance of the property losing its value, less of a chance of having significant vacancies, less old properties and more new properties, where they can sort of project that the estimate costs are not, the maintenance costs are not going to be too overwhelming. So they'll probably, just by virtue of what they'll allow and what they won't allow, they're probably going to direct you towards more, I don't know what to call it, vanilla type investments, which is not a bad thing. I mean, they are safe and stable, but it depends on what kind of paycheck you're looking for on a monthly basis, I guess.
Right. I think that's, again, like what you had mentioned now is would be for a loan, right? Like if they want to direct you to those kind of like more safe, like, Yeah, I think like for like Presti as well, I think it's like the minimum value of like one property needs to be like isemanen or above.
Oh, like, even for a resident?
Yes, I think so.
Okay, I thought that was just a requirement for a non-resident. Okay, so, well, then you're looking at a cash deposit that's going to be equal to whatever you'll be buying in cash, right? Because you're looking at...
Right, exactly. So it would be, it would come down to the same thing. Like probably, as I said in the email, it probably will be something 3 to 5 million yen in cash, like so, no matter what option I go for.
Which is, I mean, that's the starting point of what you'll be able to get if you were to own the entire unit, just a condo unit on your own, right? 3 to 5 million is what we call a low budget investment unit starts for.
Right, right.
So not much of a difference from your cash outlay there.
Mm-hmm. So I think I'm tending also more like towards a cash purchase, I guess, like just to keep the initial like expense kind of low and not owing any money to anyone, I guess, and then see like, you know, how does it yeah. work, how does it feel?
I mean, look, that's the reason that I personally like cash purchases too, is because you're in control. You don't need mm-hmm. to buy what anybody else thinks you should be buying and what they might be conservatively thinking is more appropriate. But look, again, that's just me. I can't really say one of them is better than the other. It's total personal preference.
Right. Absolutely. I do understand that.
So, I mean, maybe it'll help if we just compare what you'll get in both cases, right? So if you're looking at, I'm assuming that you would be going for the minimum loan, right? The SEMA?
Right, yes. I think anything else would be a bit out of my league again, I think.
So if we're looking, at a single asset that's valued, whose market price is about senman, that would normally be, and it has to be a single asset, right?
I think that's what they said, yes. Like one property needs to be valued, isemanen or more.
Okay, so you're looking at something that would generate in Tokyo or Osaka maybe 5% before tax, if we're lucky. 5.5% if we're super lucky. And then in other cities, maybe up to 5.5%, 6-ish. And if you're going to be looking at a property that's probably built around 2000 or maybe 1995, in a fairly, well, in Tokyo and Osaka, maybe not super central, but another city is probably a fairly central location. And then if you're using that same amount, so the 3 to 5 million you're going to be buying in cash, then you could probably branch out into satellite cities, prefectural capitals, so places like, if it's near Tokyo, maybe places like Saitama or Chiba City, maybe Kobe if it's around Osaka. For 3 to 5, maybe closer to 5, you could definitely buy into Fukuoka as well.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely Nagoya. You could definitely buy in Sapporo as well, but there we want to aim for higher yields because the winters can be rough on maintenance and also longer vacancies. Maybe Kyoto if we're lucky. Kumamoto. Those sort of places. If you're going for a single asset at senman yen via a loan, I'm guessing that the lenders will probably direct you to Tokyo, Osaka, maybe Kobe, Yokohama, Fukuoka, but I'm guessing not any other cities.
I think they said it's only Tokyo and the surrounding areas, Chiba.
Okay, so that sounds like totally the non-resident loan. What's the interest rate on that one? Do you remember?
2.3, I guess.
Okay.
For 10 years.
Okay. So
it might be as well that it's like the non-resident loan, but that's what they told me.
I think the non-resident loan, the interest rate was a little bit higher, but it sounds like the other criteria are quite identical.
Okay. So I do not have permanent residency, so maybe that's...
Okay. So it is a non-resident. Okay. It is non-resident.
Okay, that's what you mean with a non-resident.
Okay. So it is a non-resident loan, but they're not forcing you to set up a company because you are actually living in Japan, right?
Right.
They didn't mention you'd need to set up a company or have a corporate structure, right?
No, they just asked me for my employment situation.
Okay, so that's what it is. It's a non-resident loan, just without the corporate requirement.
Right.
Well, okay. Like that. Well, do you know when you're going to get your residency?
I think that depends. I am here in Japan now since 5 years, I guess. So okay. If I go with the normal one, then probably a few more years, I guess. Or otherwise, if I can apply for this highly skilled specialist visa, it might be quicker. But I do not know if I qualify for that.
Well, I would definitely advise, if you're going to go for a loan, I definitely advise to do that when you've got your permanency, because then you'll be able to approach a few more banks and you're going to get lower interest rates and you'll be able to purchase in other locations as well.
Right, because otherwise, again, like it just shaves off like 2.5% on the total yield, right?
Yes, but I mean, it's not going to be a lot better. It's still an investment loan, so it's not going to be low rates like the homeowner loans. It's probably going to be somewhere between 1.5% to 2%.
Okay, yeah.
So it's a little bit better, but the main thing is that it's not going to be only Tokyo and it's not going to be only Senma.
Okay, so that's like more freedom.
It's a lot more flexible. Yeah, it's a lot more flexible. Okay. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Otherwise, before that, I don't know that there's a huge advantage. I mean, there's not a huge advantage to getting a loan if it's with these terms, I would think. The LTV ratio is going to be about the same. So you're still going to have to put in somewhere between 30 to 50% cash.
Right.
That's not going to change. For investment loans, maybe closer to 30, 40 than 40, 50.
Right. I think they told me like 30 down is like the minimum.
Yeah.
For that one. Yeah. Okay. But it sounds probably like a better idea to go with a cash purchase initially and then see like where things lead in that sense. Right.
That's my tendency, but again, that's my personal tendency. I can't speak for everyone.
No, I think I do agree with you there. I guess in that sense, that might make more sense in my situation, at least for the moment.
Yeah.
Something like completely different. We were thinking about, I mean, that's maybe longer down the road, but like, what do you think like personally about like, you know, buying like a full, like whole apartment blocks? And then also like living within like that block, like let's say you have like a full block with like the top floor where you can live in, and then you have like maybe four units or something like that, which you rent out. Is this something like you've had people do, or like do you have some?
People do that, but one of the main advantages in doing that is if you can get a loan with home loan terms. That you're actually also using as an investment, and to satisfy that criteria, half of the living space or more has to be your personal residence. So if you're buying a 4 to 6 unit block, you can't just live in one of them. You have to, for example, if it's two floors, one floor has to be you, the other floor has to be the investment units.
Right.
And otherwise, it's a normal investment loan. So there's not really any advantage in you living there unless you want to be close to your tenants. But if your tenants are going to be Japanese tenants, having a gaijin landlord living overhead, that's going to freak them out. So it's not necessarily going to help you to occupy those units.
Yeah. No, I was more thinking about like this kind of like hybrid situation, because now for example our company went like fully remote and it doesn't seem like they go back ever.
Yeah,
so we could basically like, as well, I mean, that's definitely something I have to get my wife on board as well, but where you basically get like both of these, like, you know, pay your own, like your tenants pay your own rent as well in that sense. Like,
I would, in Japan, I would only go that way if you're planning to market specifically to foreign tenants.
Okay.
If you're going for Japanese tenants, that's going to right there cut half of your potential tenants just because the gaijin landlord is living there.
Oh, okay, I see. So it makes more sense to have like units all over the place and let them pay your rent like that. Like,
well, it's a good idea to own a small building if you can afford it rather than individual units, because you do have a much larger land plot, so you stand to gain more.
Mm-hmm.
And you also have the creative freedom to consider. You don't have to do it whenever you want, but you can consider down the track turning it, for example, into a Airbnb if the local municipality allows it, or into a short-term rentals more easily. And you can decide that you can also rent out the units as an office and not necessarily only as that. So you have more creative freedom with the property. Whereas if you own single units in blocks that have owner unions and building management companies, there's going to be a lot of bylaws that you're going to have to adhere to. So you're not going to be able to do nearly as much with the property as you would have been if you owned all of it. But to buy into those, you're never looking at less than, I mean, in reasonable areas, you're never looking at less than 30, 35 million.
Okay, yeah, probably around that.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I think that's like definitely like no question like for the first purchase, but just something like was like in my mind, I guess.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Let's say like I'd go with just an initial like cash purchase for like anywhere like between 3 to 5 million. And you know, how is that like in from a standpoint of like diversification? Is this like you would only have like one unit, right? Or would you say like it makes more sense, okay, no, like save up more money and then go like for like three, for example? So maybe in case like something happens or like some tenants are like not in there, like these kind of things, like what do you think about that?
Well, diversity is always a good idea if it makes sense within your budget. But let's say if your entire budget is 5 million yen, then yes, you could potentially get two and a half million yen properties.
Yeah.
But then by definition, you're buying in very specific locations and you're marketing to a very specific tenant profile.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not really gaining all that diversity. You're pretty much, I mean, the deals would come from very particular location. The tenant would always be low income earners. If you've got, let's say, Hapyakuman or Senman, like 80,000, 100,000 US, then maybe it makes more sense to divide that into two or three units.
Mm-hmm. So if each is around like 3 million yen, something like that.
Either that or maybe something like 144, 146. So you've got something a bit lower end, something a bit higher end, and the tenant profile is different, the location is different, the size is different, because obviously properties that are up to 20, 25 square meters attract singles, and properties that are bigger attract couples, and beyond that it's families. So I would try to diversify within the tenant profile if I can as well.
Mm-hmm.
And because the economy, depending on how it goes and how the location specifically goes, the economy can be kinder or less kind to families, or kinder or less kind to singles, depending on what's happening at any given time.
Right.
And also some locations are more blue collar, some locations are more white collar. So if you've got five, I wouldn't try to diversify. I'd probably aim to get the best property that you can within that.
Mm-hmm.
If you got eight or more, it starts to make more sense, I'd say.
Now we're going to interrupt this broadcast. I always wanted to say that we're going to interrupt this broadcast to give you a quick reminder that NTI is now partnered with Mita Securities Hospitality Property Fund, and they're offering their mind-blowingly gorgeous Machiya townhouses in Kyoto. So there's four of them, each about 100 years or older, lovingly restored and renovated to modern standards luxury. Stunning architecture and comfort, all the modern conveniences, including your scenic indoor or outdoor bath, spectacular dining and sitting rooms, disgustingly decadent Japanese or Western style bedrooms, high-speed Wi-Fi internet, kitchen, outdoor decks, Japanese gardens, the works. Now, each of these homes can comfortably host two or three families, including kids, so anywhere from one or two guests and all the way up to a dozen or so. And you can rent the entire house to yourself. So no other guests. It's all yours. Run around naked all day and night long, if that's your thing. Supreme Japanese-style luxury accommodation. And since at the moment there are still no foreign tourists in Kyoto, these places are available for rent at ridiculously low prices. So we're talking as little as $430 for a whole week. That's right, luxury accommodation for an entire clan, two families or more, for as little as $400, $500, or $600 a week. Obviously, the longer the stay, the cheaper the rate is, but you can rent these for anywhere between one or two nights and up to a month or more. So perfect for a weekend getaway, extended holiday, workcation, family reunion, company retreat, or even as a gift to a valued client, whatever you might have in mind. And if you book these through our website, you're also going to get an added bonus of one or more 3,000 yen. So that's $30 QUO cards, Q-U-O. Those are gift cards that you can use all around the country in convenience stores, restaurants, various stores, lifestyle shops, you name it. The number of cards you'll get depends on the length of the stay, but you'll always get at least one of these. So if you're in Japan, or even if you're out of Japan, but you think that you might be able to get in sometimes in the next year or two, and you've been thinking about spending some time in Kyoto, this is your chance to nab the best accommodation deal possible. So we'll link to the bookings page, which also has some amazing photo galleries for each of these properties on offer. Now, they all come with a fully equipped kitchen, but you can also choose to have your meals delivered to the property if that's your thing. The operator can arrange that for you at very reasonable prices. And if you can't see the show notes for any reason, just go to our website, nippontradings.com. That's N-I-P-P-O-N tradings with an S, all one word, nippontradings.com/Kyoto-holiday-rentals. Or just go to nippontradings.com and you'll see the Kyoto Holiday Rentals option on the top right menu bar. Now, we are already taking bookings, so some of the properties may not be available on your dates, but me, the security guys, are super accommodating and they'll do their best to find you an available property for whenever it is you're planning your trip. Get on there, book your inquiry, and take that dream holiday in Kyoto that you've been fantasizing about while these phenomenal prices are still available. And now, back to the podcast.
Okay, yeah, I see. But it's not particularly like a problem to just like buy one property first and then like see like how it goes, and then maybe later down the road like buy like another one.
That's what most of our customers do. Yeah, they test one, they wait for about a year, they see that the income is okay, that the tenants are reasonably easy to deal with, and then they expand their budget accordingly.
Okay, good. Makes sense. That makes sense. Okay.
Same with buildings, by the way. If you were talking about a higher budget, you would start with a smaller, more safe and stable central building. And then on the next purchase, after everything goes according to plan, on the next purchase, you buy a bigger building and maybe in a more high yield location and so forth. So same dynamics.
Same principle applies. Okay. I see. I wrote down some stuff I might be interested in talking about. So like another thing is, well, like, as you said, like how hands off can this whole thing be, like basically?
It depends on if you're working directly with the third parties or if you're working with someone. Like, how's your Japanese, by the way?
I think I'm fairly... I'm okay getting around. I mean, like, my company is well, like probably 80% Japanese, 20% English. So,
okay. Can you read and understand written documents in Japanese, including all the kanji and stuff?
I'd say like mostly, but I think like if it comes to like those legal documents and stuff like that, I probably would have like a hard time there, or like
that's until settlement. But I mean, after settlement, let's say for example you get a monthly report from the property manager just detailing the income and expenses and that sort of thing, and you get an annual report from building management saying that they're planning a renovation for next year and they want you to sign if you approve this and this, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think probably like given enough time to read, I think it would be able to like figure it out.
Okay. Well, I mean, we represent customers either or. So we either help them until settlement and then we leave them directly communicating with the property management company, building management company, and the insurance company. Mm-hmm. And then it's basically just receiving and consuming documents until there's a decision to be made. So for a vacancy or for a building management owners union voting about something, insurance policies, you might need to make a few choices when you renew a policy. But it's fairly hands-off. The more properties you accumulate, the more it becomes hands-on, because every once in a while you're going to have a vacancy, every once in a while there's going to be something that's happened in the building that needs attendance. So we can represent you post-settlement as well. We can handle everything on your behalf and just give you bottom lines to sign off on.
Okay, yeah. And then in my opinion, I'd like to be like very, very hands-off, I guess.
Well, I guess at least for the start, maybe for the first couple of years, maybe you can work through us and then you can decide by yourself if you want to take on matters to your own hand.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Like, I mean, yeah, if it makes sense to like take over something, but I think like in general, I'm probably like a very like hands-off investor so far. I mean, that's why
yep.
I kind of like these like mutual funds and stuff like that. It's just...
That's most of our customers, again.
You throw money at it and the rest handles itself.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's still decisions to be made, but we'll try to... we'll try to just give you really summaries and just a yes, no kind of decision.
But that could be with you as well, right? You say basically, okay, this is coming up and like we would like to decide on this and that. And
yep. That's what we do for 85-90% of our customers.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds probably exactly for what I'm looking for.
Mm.
Okay. Good. Yeah, I think it's really just for me, like try to like, test it out. I guess that's how I learn best, like take a small amount of money and just see how it works, how it feels, if it's something I can imagine keep on doing or not. Yeah.
Well, 4 or 5 million yen will enable me to give you a few more choices. If we're sticking to 2 or 3 million yen, it's going to be very specific locations, very specific types of properties. If you can stretch your budget to 4 or 5, then we can look at a few cities. It's still not going to be Tokyo or Osaka, but at least a good few other places. So that enables me to give you some potentials from different types of, again, different types of properties, different locations and different tenant profiles.
Mm-hmm. And so then if you say like a 5 million, like what do we speak of, like, you know, like on top of 5 million, like this kind of like the value of the property is 5 million, right?
The purchase price of 5 million, you mean the purchase costs?
Yes, like everything like included. Like,
so worst case, we usually estimate 20% purchase costs. 20%. And usually by settlement, it's going to be closer to something like 17, maybe 18%.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes the realtor's fee, which is 3% plus 60,000 plus tax. So it usually works out to be, for cheaper properties, usually works out to be 4.5-5%. And then our fee, which is 5%. We have a minimum cap too, but the minimum cap is 5% of 5 million. So that sounds like what you'd be looking at. And then the purchase tax, which is a bill that you get after a settlement, depends on the official valuation of the property, which can be different to market price, but it usually averages as 2.5-2.6%. And then the legal and registration fees, again, they vary depending on the official evaluation, but they're usually between 3-8%. It's a bit hard to tell in advance, because again, the official eval can be quite different to market price.
Mm-hmm.
So we add all of that together and we start with a worst case estimate of 20%. And like I said, by settlement, it'll usually be down to about 17, 18. For cheaper properties, if the budget is higher, it's gonna be in closer to 15, 16. If it's even higher, mm-hmm. like for a building, it's usually somewhere between 11 to 13 and so forth.
Okay, I see. Okay, so you'd say like with a 4 or 5 million property, you probably look at like actually 6 million, six something for like actual purchase costs all together.
Worst case, hopefully less than mm-hmm. that. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I think that might be possible. Yeah, I think maybe with like this kind of like saving up for a bit and selling some stocks or something like
well,
that.
With 5 million, we can probably even look at Yokohama, Kawasaki. We see some deals coming out of there at 5 million occasionally. Kobe City, so it would get you close to Tokyo and Osaka at least. And yeah. definitely Fukuoka as well, which is a very good location. Nagoya, I'm just thinking of the bigger cities. So Nagoya 2, Nagoya we can get even cheaper, but Nagoya can be a bit rougher tenant-wise. It's more blue-collar than the rest of the locations I've just mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, it's Japan. You don't have like delinquents, but you do have occasional late payments or maybe a few more vacancies compared to other cities.
Okay, I see. Okay, so like basically the pros of like having properties in like these areas is just like less hassle in general, or like easier resale value and stuff like that.
Shorter vacancies for one. It's easier to populate a property when it becomes vacant. The other thing is that, yes, the value tends to retain itself a lot better than in smaller places. Mm-hmm. And even, I mean, if the grand scheme of things, if the economy in Japan does well, then those locations are poised to gain in value. Whereas with the other locations, they might gain slightly occasionally, but they're definitely not going to be in leaps and bounds. But the upside of the smaller locations is that the yield tends to be higher because property prices are lower and the rental yields, percentage-wise, the rental yields can be higher. So they can be as high as 7 or 8% before tax.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Whereas all of the other places that I've mentioned, Tokyo, Osaka, I'd say not beyond 6, and that's rare. Fukuoka, Nagoya, not beyond 7, and that's rare. So that's the only, but if you're looking at a first investment, I probably would advise to make it a bit more safe and stable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As you expand, maybe get a bit more adventurous, try some prefectural capitals, satellite cities, and so forth.
Okay, makes sense. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so basically like this, the rental income, is it calculated as just regular income? Like, how do you say? Like,
for income tax purposes?
Yes, right.
Yes, regular. It just gets added to your total income and you get taxed based on that.
Right, so you're taxed based on your income.
Yes, but you'll be carrying your purchase costs forward for 3 years. So for the first 3 years, you're going to be tax-free on the rental income. Because your purchase costs, let's say that, let's call it 20%, just a worst case. So the 20% purchase costs that you've paid, you're going to be declaring them as expenses. So you're obviously not going to be making 20% rental income every year. So for the first 3 years, which is the limit of how long you can carry them, the property rental income will not be factored into your income tax.
Okay, so it's tax deductible. Okay, I see.
Yes.
Okay. Is there like other things as well you can, like from a tax advantage point, like to lower your income tax?
As an individual, there's not a huge amount that you can do. You can, for example, if the property is in Fukuoka, you take a trip to Fukuoka, that may be tax deductible because you came to look at the property.
Okay, I see.
That kind of thing. But beyond that, not much. But I do. Do you have an accountant that you work with for your taxes?
No, not yet. But that's definitely something I have to look into.
As a salaryman, that's not really necessary. But I'll put you in touch with an accountant who can probably advise a bit more. It's a good idea if you will want to, because you do already have an income in Japan. It's probably a good idea to hire an accountant as soon as you start purchasing property, so they can start claiming deductions.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I guess, yeah. They're also probably able to
a very affordable one. They'll only charge you, I think, 5,000 yen per property per annum. Is nothing serious.
Okay. Do they also help with like I don't know, like let's for example say like, you know, the whole like stock thing or like these kind of things you can use them for?
If that's part of your income, they'll factor your income and your salary and everything into your income tax, but they don't advise on stocks and stuff.
Okay, yeah, no, I mean, like, for example, let's say, like, I sell some kind of, like, stocks and stuff like that, if they can take care of that as well, like...
They'll take care of your income and expense declarations and minimize your taxes as much as possible, wherever your income might be coming from. But that price that I've quoted, the 5,000 yen, is if they're only dealing with your property income, because you've also got a salary and you've also got other sources of income, and they'll need to quote you on that separately.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, but still, I think it seems kind of affordable, I guess, from what you said, like 5,000 yen
per property. Well, for the property, but I'm guessing they wouldn't be too expensive on the other fronts as well. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I think that would be great if you probably have like some people you work together with already, or like if you can like let me know their contacts.
I'll send you an email with I'll send an introductory email directly to you and the accountant, and you can take it with them.
Okay, good. Thank you very much. Something else, it's like, what would you say, for example, you know, what kind of like percentage of the unit price should you have like on hand, like liquid cash, for example, you know, in case of like repairs or like these kind of things? Is there like some kind of like rule of thumb? Or
there's a statistical average, but those averages come into play when you've got a large portfolio over a large period, over a long period of time. I'm just hesitant to give that as a rule of thumb, because if you're only owning the one property, mm-hmm. you could be looking at a situation where, you know, you purchase the property and then for the next 15 years, nothing happens. The tenant stays happy and everything's okay. And then they could move out a month after settlement and you're suddenly faced with a large renovation bill, right? So I'm just a bit hesitant. Right. I could say statistically, probably put 10% of the gross income aside for vacancies and maintenance and so forth.
Okay. Yeah,
kind of and you should probably bear in mind that if you're looking at a 5 million yen budget, you're probably looking at a 1R or 1DK at most. Mm-hmm. And those properties usually, unless someone's lived there, like a dirty old man lived there for 20 years, but in all normal situations, you're probably not looking at anything beyond $2,000 for renovation and repairs.
Okay, so that's probably like whenever like there's a tenant renewal, like you look at some kind of costs surrounding that.
Yes, so we normally evaluate something between $400 to $700 per year of tenancy.
Okay.
And single men tend to cost more, single women tend to cost less, depending on their age as well. A young professional takes care of the property better than an old pensioner kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So it varies, but I'd say if you want to be on the safe side, put 10% of the gross rental income aside every year.
For eventually.
In most cases, that should cover it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, it's just like trying to like wrap my head around, like, you know, like what kind of like costs could you look at or could you face in terms of
like some idea, like for example, a brand, let's say you've got an air conditioner unit in there, that's pretty common. They usually go after anywhere between 10 to 15 years. So a brand new one, as part of a renovation of the apartment, a brand new one might be 75,000 yen, including installation and removal of the old one. Mm-hmm. And if the hot boiler goes, which is after 15, 20 years, that could be anywhere between, depending if it's electric or gas. So anywhere between Juman to Nijuman, would I? A complete replacement of the bathroom, but that's really something that you'll only do if it's never been done in the property since it was built, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That might be 10,000, but that's very rare that it happens. So for example, if you're going to be purchasing a property that's vacant, then you're going to get a property that's been recently renovated. So you know that you're free of any big expenses for at least a good 5-6 years. If you're buying a property that's tenanted, then you're buying straight into income from day one. But then if the tenant's been in place for, say, 10 or 15 years, which is not rare in Japan, it's quite common, then you know that when they're moving out, you might be up for a bigger bill, right? So there's pros and cons to both situations. But we'll try to evaluate when we recommend particular properties and we start getting the tenant due diligence information and we know their profile and how long they're living there, then we can probably make some estimates as to what it's going to cost you if and when they move out.
Right. Okay. So that's all information you're getting, right? Like basically before you buy, like how long has the tenant been there? And like,
yes. So that's all part of the due diligence, but not all of it will be available before you make an offer. So the agents here, it's a very active market and the agents don't go out of their way before they get an offer on the table. Mm-hmm. So we can submit an offer and that offer will always going to write is pending due diligence, meaning if we find anything about the building's renovation history or the reserve funds or the tenant information that's not satisfactory, we can still pull back the offer. It's not legally committing.
Okay.
So that's what we'll do. And then we'll start getting due diligence info, and then we'll make recommendations. We're going to say, okay, well, the risk factor here is slightly higher than what we thought because of this and this and that. So maybe we can reduce the offer by, say, 10% because of that. And so forth.
Okay.
Or if there's a huge red flag, we might say, no, let's not go with this one because this and this and this might happen. Right.
Okay. Good. Yeah, I think that's definitely something I need like your experience and like input on, because I don't think that I'm going to be able to like do that on my own.
Yep, we're happy to. That's what we get hired for.
Okay. Good. Let me quickly see if I have anything else here. Okay, I don't know, like, is anything else like I wrote down is like, you know, is there a chance of like a total loss or something? Like, is this even possible, like that you are out on like whatever you put in and it's just gone?
It hasn't happened to us yet, but I suppose if the building gets destroyed in an earthquake, that's definitely one option where it might happen.
Mm-hmm.
You've got insurance that covers the interior of the property, and that covers up to 50% in case of an earthquake.
Okay.
And then if the building is completely destroyed, then the building's reserve fund pool will be first used to remove the remains of the building, and then whatever's left will be distributed between the owners.
Okay, I see. And in that case, still, like, does insurance pay? Like, the actual, like, half of the value of the apartment you bought, or is that gone as well in that sense?
Yeah, no, you get both.
Okay.
So you get both. Yeah. So there's several levels of compensation. That's one of them. The reserve fund distribution is another, if there is anything in the reserve fund. And then the tenant would have their own insurance for their own possessions and any bodily harm and so forth.
Okay, I see.
And yep. We would also get, we would recommend, we get by default for all of our customers, unless they instruct us not to, we get coverage for death in the property.
Okay, in case a tenant dies. Or like,
yeah, so we used to only get it for elderly tenants, and then we had one person die who was like 47 or something. Mm-hmm. So these days we get it for all tenants.
Okay.
And that's an extra, now it's about 30, 35 bucks a year, but it might go up as the population gets older, I'm assuming, because it used to be about 20 bucks a year, like 2,000 yen. Now it's 3,035. And that covers you for up to 1 million yen in renovation, removal, repairs, and also for 2 years of missing or reduced rental income, because it could be a bit harder to rent the unit out once someone's died in there. The property managers are obliged to tell the first tenant afterwards.
Right. Okay.
So that's highly, I mean, for the amount it costs you every year, it's really highly recommended to get it.
Mm-hmm.
We have had, I'm sorry to have to say this, but we do regularly get aged tenants dying in properties. So it's definitely not an uncommon occurrence. It's definitely worth having.
Oh, yeah. It makes sense as well in Japan, I guess, with the aging population.
Yep.
Right. Quickly getting back to, like, before when we talked about, like, you know, earthquakes, natural disasters, if you, like, buy properties, how important is it to, like, check, like, hazard maps and, like, where the properties are located and stuff like that?
Well, with earthquakes, I'd say it's like Russian roulette, right? Like, I mean, there are certain areas that are very earthquake prone, but having said that, that's all of Tokyo, right?
Right.
So there's really, I mean, I don't think there's anywhere we could buy where we could avoid earthquakes. So there aren't any particular hazard maps for earthquake. What you do want to look at is the potential for landslides. And the realtors are obliged to report that to you before you purchase a property. So if that property is in a landslide zone, they'll let you know. Because when earthquakes do occur, or even when typhoons occur, areas that are in landslide hazard zones could definitely be damaged, as well as tenants. They could be evacuated and then never come back, sort of thing. So that's something that we need to be aware of. But aside from that, I mean, I wouldn't purchase right next to a nuclear power plant, but otherwise, that's it.
Okay, and like as well, like close to the ocean in that sense, you know, like tsunami areas or like floor liquefaction, these kind of things.
That's kind of like the earthquake, right? Like whenever an earthquake hits, a tsunami could hit in that spot as well if it's near the ocean. And also, I don't know what's near the ocean. Like in Tohoku, areas were, you know, obliterated. There were a good few kilometers from the beachfront. So I don't. We haven't specifically. We don't get too many properties that are right near the beach, except in some locations, just because. Usually near the beach means it's a long walk to the nearest train station. So unless somebody's aiming for a beachside property, we normally don't get anything that's closer than 15, 20-minute walk to the ocean. But if anything turns up, we can just review it on a case-by-case basis, I suppose.
Yeah, no, I just was wondering, as like, for example, like this as well with tsunami and things, it's covered as well, like an earthquake insurance, or is that like something
Yes,
different?
because tsunamis are initiated by earthquakes, so they're
By an
covered,
earthquake.
not explicitly, but they're covered as part of earthquake coverage. So our fires, the building maintenance takes care of typhoon damages because that's mostly to the exterior of the building. What else? Yeah, I mean, there's floods and water, which would partly cover you for landslides, but landslides, I would avoid areas with the landslide hazards in any case.
Yeah, good. And just very basic question again is like the whole like repair funds and like these the sink funds, that's paid by the tenant, right?
Nope, that's paid by the owner.
Paid by the owner. Okay, that's like not included in rent.
So when we give you deal analysis spreadsheets to look at a property before you're thinking to apply for it, that would show what the building fees are. And those would be management fees, which can have a few components, and reserve funds separately. And then we would also, after we apply, we would get the total amount in the reserve fund that's been accumulated, and we would also get the building's renovation history. And we like to make sure that the two correlate. So if the reserve fund pool is depleted, we want to see that that's reflected in pretty significant renovations in the last decade or so. And on the other hand, if no renovations have been done in the last decade or so, we'd like to see that there's plenty of money in the reserve funds to pull them off when they're required. And if there is no recent renovations and also no reserve fund, we need to see a really good reason for that. Otherwise, we'd probably say not to go ahead with that.
I see. Yeah, I think that's all the questions I've written down here so far. Okay, that's it.
Okay. So what I'll do is, now that I know your budget, do you have any minimum yield requirements, any particular location criteria, anything that we should be basing the potentials we sent to you on?
No, not particular. I think like really like this as like an initial purchase and like this kind of like
Just getting to know
trying,
more. Yeah.
yeah, just trying to get to know get a feeling of like how things work. So I don't really like mind anything. I think probably if it's like a kind of like more like a secure, stable area that you say like it's easy to tenant find tenants
Okay.
and resale value is kind of like
All
okay as
right.
well.
So I'll get Pretty, that you've been communicating with, I'll get her to send you all potentials that we have that are within the, what, 5 or 6 million? What are we looking at?
I'd say like five, I guess.
5 million.
Like,
Okay. So all properties that are up to around 5 million. She might include a few that are slightly more than that because we can negotiate the price sometimes. And that'll give you a rough idea of what you can have within that price range. And then you can get back to us with any questions, or we can just like play make believe and say which one we like more than the other one and why. Then, if at any point you're ready to move forward and you want to be able to start submitting offers and get your foot in the door and conduct due diligence, let us know. And then we'll kick off the engagement process, which means we'll need two forms signed and stamped, and we'll need our fee estimate paid in advance for the first purchase. And then we'll credit or debit you post-settlement, depending on whatever the actual purchase price ends up being. From the second purchase and onwards, we can just bill you on settlement.
Sounds good. Yeah, I think like as well, as I said, like I think in the email, I'm like not particularly in a hurry to buy anything and maybe like need some time as well to like save up some more money in cash.
You're already on our mailing list, right?
Right, I asked Priti to put me on there.
Okay, so you'll get,
like a feel for...
Yeah, so you'll get occasional sample listings, but those are going to be all of them, including way, stuff that's way over your budget and holiday properties and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's completely okay. That's
now that I know your criteria, I'll tell her to also send you specific listings and spreadsheets for those listings that fit your criteria. So you'll be able to dig a little bit deeper into the ones that would potentially suit you.
Suit? Yeah. Thank
you. Oh, sorry. I think we're cutting out there a bit.
I can still hear you. Can you hear me?
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Good. Yeah, that sounds great. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
As well, like I have to say, like really very, very appreciate your podcast work you're doing. It's fantastic and like a lot of information, like really great content. That's
very kind of you. Thank you for saying that.
Yeah, it's like a funny story, but I think like your podcast was my... 2019 top listened podcast on Spotify, I think.
Oh no, I'm blushing now. Stop. Okay. Thank you very much.
Right. I think I had like while working, just like keep listening to your podcast.
That's brilliant. Thank you very much for that.
Good. Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you very much for your time today. And you helped me a lot, like in kind of making up my mind. That's great.
My pleasure. So we'll start emailing you with samples and we'll take it from there.
Yeah, please. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Good. Have a nice weekend. Bye-bye.
You too.
All right. That was a good long talk. Hope you found some value in it. And if you've got any questions that you'd like answered, we'd love it if you could hit us up in the comment section and let us know. We're always happy to talk shop. No charge or any kind of commitment required. Just drop us a line and we'll get back to you with some answers. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa, and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company, and you've got any sort of business or visa-related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com. And he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes Store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time. And until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku.